Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host based in New York City, Ankit Panda, and joining me today on the podcast is my colleague at the Diplomat, Shannon Tiazzi. But we have a special guest here with us tonight. Joining us today is J. Michael Cole, a name you might recognize from our Flashpoints blog. Michael is a journalist based in Taiwan. He's been covering all sorts of goings on the island for The Diplomat and other publications for a few years now. And the reason we actually specifically have him on tonight is because he recently released a book called Black Island, 2 Years of Activism in Taiwan. And the title is pretty much explanatory of the contents of this book. Basically, Michael has been covering and documenting the rise of civic activism in Taiwan over the past 2 years. As even the most casual observers of Taiwanese affairs would know, Taiwan has seen an uprising in terms of civic participation from its citizens, particularly the youth. The Sunflower Movement is obviously the highlight from the past year. Michael's been right there on the front lines. So we're very happy to have him here today. Thanks a lot for joining us, Michael.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you tell us about this book? What made you write it? And what overall is the message that you're trying to get out with this collection of essays?
Right. Well, it's actually a very interesting project for me because I've been in Taiwan for about 10 years, and I made my reputation as a journalist that was covering predominantly defense issues, cross-strait relations, politics in the Taiwan Strait. And I traveled a lot with the Taiwanese military, wrote for other publications about the Taiwanese military. And about 2 years and a half ago, I started writing articles about social movements in Taiwan. So a lot of the people who got to know me over the years, including, I would assume, readers of my articles in The Diplomat, started asking, why the hell is Michael Cole all of a sudden writing about street protests over home demolitions in Taiwan and all that? It's been an interesting journey because, I mean, there's always been protesting in Taiwan. This is not a new phenomenon. What is new is that the nature of the participants was very different. And it was becoming clear, very evident, that they were here to stay as well. And that they would probably have more of an impact on policy than the previous ones that tended to be led by the opposition parties and involved older generations of Taiwanese. So there was an interesting transformation. And the language that was being used, which was much more in terms of civic nationalism rather than we are Taiwanese, they are Chinese. It was more values-based and simply based on ethnic notions of identity, if you will. So to me, it became clear after a while, the more I spent time with them on the streets and I documented their efforts doing photography as well, was that this might very well be the next big story for Taiwan and perhaps even cross-strait relations. And as a journalist who is based in Taiwan, it's always been very frustrating, the diplomat aside, to publish in-depth articles about what's going on in Taiwan in international media. Most of the time I would be told by editors overseas, very interesting, but this is too insider baseball for us. Very interesting, but ultimately human rights violations in almost every single other country in the region are far worse than they are in Taiwan. And isn't Taiwan a democracy anyway? Now, of course, there were issues over the quality of Taiwan's democracy. And this is the reason why we had all these protests in the past couple of years. But it became a way for me, using publications that kindly agreed to publish my work, to help tell Taiwan's story and discuss issues of values and identity and the problems that we were seeing in the Taiwanese system. And of course, every one of those issues, even if they were at heart, they were very domestic, there's always a China angle. Because ultimately, if you cannot trust government officials to deal properly with issues of urban renewal, then how can you possibly trust those same officials to deal with an authoritarian regime in China that does not even recognize your sovereignty? So there was a very interesting connection here that I felt needed to be told to the world. So I started writing these articles, and then it snowballed, and it ultimately led to the Sunflower Movement occupation last year. And then by that point, and thanks to the Sunflower Movement, then a lot of more people overseas started paying attention to Taiwan and realized that there was something serious going on here. And But the problem that I then encountered is that most people had not paid attention to what had been going on prior to the Sunflower Movement. So when the students decided to occupy the parliament on March 18, 2014, the reaction overseas was mostly, oh, this is spontaneous, this is irrational, why are they doing this? If they're not happy with the government, they can protest peacefully, or if they're not happy with the government, they can vote them out in the next elections. So the goal with my book is the first third or so is titled The Road to 318, 318 being March 18, the day of the occupation, to demonstrate that all the rational things, all the peaceful protesting, all the public hearings and the discussions and all that did take place in those 2 years prior to the occupation, and there was very little, if any, reaction from the government, which continued with its policies, assuming that it would get away with it. So I think the last third part of my book is about the Sunflower Movement occupation. I don't even think it's the most important part of the book. I really think that the road to the Sunflower Movement is the important part, because this is the key to understanding Taiwanese society and all the issues that prompted a collection of something like 54 different NGOs and organizations to come together and to create what came to be known as the Sunflower Movement.
Yeah. So I just wanted to talk. So, you know, I read the introduction to your book. I unfortunately didn't have the time to read all the essays. Since a lot of them were from The Diplomat, I did have the pleasure of editing them over the past 2 years. So that was nice. I wanted to bring up something you mentioned in the introduction, which is you describe Taiwan's civic nationalism as sort of a patriotic awakening. And, you know, since you are emphasizing the road to 318, so much on this podcast so far, I just kind of wanted to see if you'd be willing to give us the very, you know, quick and dirty version of what led Taiwan's youth and many of these students and younger people in Taiwan to essentially pursue that path. What was it about politics? What was it about the quality of Taiwanese democracy that led to this chain of events that eventually culminated in the Sunflower Movement?
Yeah. Well, I think we really saw there's a constant soul searching among Taiwanese, and perhaps even more so among the younger ones, to trying to define what it means to be Taiwanese. They know that they inhabit this island nation that is officially recognized by only 22 countries worldwide. They know that they have semi-official or officially unofficial, to allude to my previous book, relations with pretty much the rest of the world. But the constant narrative is, are we Chinese? Are we Taiwanese? If we're Taiwanese, what makes us different from the Chinese? Because after all, yes, we do speak their language. Yes, our ancestors came from China. We have similarities in culture and all that. Among Taiwanese youth, especially those who were born here, or second or third generation mainlanders, I think they eventually came to a pretty solid answer in recent years by defining their nationalism again in terms of civic mindedness and values, and finally abandoning the whole green/blue divide of ethnically Taiwanese versus ethnically Chinese, and using DNA as a basis for distinguishing between a real Taiwanese and not a real Taiwanese. They have concluded, in my opinion, that anyone who has made this land their home and abides by the democratic ideals that became Taiwan over the years is a Taiwanese. Whether your DNA background is mainlander or Hakka or Aboriginal or Taiwanese or whatnot, or even if you're a person like me who's from a different country but has chosen to make Taiwan his or her home, it makes you a Taiwanese. You're part of that experiment. It's a melting pot of societies and ethnicities, lots of influences from abroad, from Japan, from the West. So it's a constantly transforming political entity and identity. And those young people, I think they realize that this is the key to defining who they are, and this is what needs to be fought on in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk politics for a second, since you're describing this process of transformation in Taiwan. And what I want to know is the KMT, Taiwan's grand old party, which has been in charge for the majority of Taiwan's history. Is the KMT adapting, in your view? And Shannon, I haven't forgotten that you're there. We're going to get your thoughts on how China's reacting to the current change in Taiwan. But Michael, what's your view of the KMT? How are they adapting? How are they not adapting? How do you see Taiwanese politics, primarily between the two main parties, the DPP and the KMT, playing out in the next few years?
Well, the KMT, like everything else, is no monolith. There are very conservative elements within the party and quite influential elements, I would add, that are either extremely dismissive of the whole sunflower movement thing or are simply refusing to adapt or to change their policies for a variety of reasons. But there are also a good number of elements within the party who realize that they had crossed a line that they should not have crossed last year and perhaps even in earlier years. I think those individuals realize that society now has told them in no uncertain terms, that we no longer trust you. You have made it very clear that we cannot trust you with people's homes in Taiwan, for example. So why the hell should we trust you negotiating with the people back in Beijing and all that? Black box trade agreements that may also have implications for freedom of expression in Taiwan and for its sovereignty and the quality of its democracy and all that. The KMT over the years has Taiwanized. I do not agree with the perception that is still held by some experts that the KMT is a foreign occupying force in Taiwan. It was so after World War II when they decided to transplant themselves after losing the civil war against the communist Chinese. Over the years, it's been 6-7 decades now, they've had no choice. If they wanted to survive, they needed to become part of this society. A large number of its members, a large number of its officials are themselves Taiwan born, so quote unquote, real Taiwanese. I hate using the term. It is now, whether it likes it or not, it must abide by democratic rules. It itself was part of that whole experiment. It was also part of the whole democratization process, even though initially it resisted those very same social forces. So yes, definitely there are people in the party who are trying to adapt, trying to bring in younger people as well, because now everybody in Taiwan who's in politics is trying to empower young individuals. If only for electoral considerations. Whether that actually changes the mindset is a different thing altogether, and that remains to be seen. But I think we want to be careful. We want to stay away from regarding the KMT as a monolith that is has not succeeded in shedding its authoritarian past and is therefore completely evil and all that. That's not the case. The key here is, social movements as well. It's a way, protesting is a way to communicate with the powers that be. Right? So you're trying to engage in a conversation with individuals and try to convince them that they need to change things. And there is this ongoing dialogue. The intervention last year by Legislative Speaker Wang Jinping, who is of the KMT, is a clear demonstration that there are senior members of the party who will agree to meet society halfway. And thanks to his intervention, the occupation itself was resolved, and it was resolved quite peacefully.
Is there any sense at all of a schism within the KMT? Obviously, President Ma Ying-jeou isn't very popular. You had the KMT being soundly defeated in the local elections last year, and a lot of people are wondering how they're going to respond. Have they come up with a unified response, or is the party kind of being pulled in different directions?
There is certainly no unified response at the moment. It looks like they can't even agree as to who should be running for president in January 2016. The KMT is rife with factionalism. There are the older conservative, quote-unquote, mainlander leaders who are being weeded out, especially under new chairperson Eric Chu, who became chairperson after the KMT was trounced on November 29 elections. In many ways, I sense that chairperson Chu is trying to do what, in my view, is the right thing, that is to open up to society and try to reform the party. The problem that he faces is that there are still very, very powerful conservative forces in his party. And President Ma Ying-jeou is part of that of that clan within the KMT, if you will. So it's extraordinarily difficult for Chu to actually lead the party in the right direction. But ultimately, I think that if they're wise enough, they will realize that it's very Darwinian, right? Failing to adapt will cost them even more, and they had clearly failed to adapt prior to the elections on November 29, and look what happened. They lost control of every single special municipality in Taiwan except one, and that one special municipality in Xinbei, the race was a lot closer than people expected. So it did send a very clear signal. It created an opportunity for the opposition DPP to win votes and to attract new voters as well, but it also demonstrated the impact of civil society on electoral politics. And this, if nothing else, will make people in politics pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Something else that comes to mind is, as you describe in the book, you know, this patriotic nationalism that's on the rise in Taiwan. Well, I guess the civic nationalism, rather, I should say,
right,
is on the rise. And obviously you have relations between China and Taiwan are also entering a new phase. And it seems like the rise of civic nationalism should be, you know, turning into a sort of a pressure cooker in terms of cross-strait relations. I think, you know, things are going to have to get to a point where Taiwan is going to have to decide what its path with China will be in the future. I mean, you have the 1992 consensus and the One China policy, but obviously there are a ton of tensions right now. The DPP, which I'd like to actually hear more about from you, and what you think about their politics for the island. But what is the way forward for Taiwan and China? And Shannon, obviously, you know, feel free to jump in here since this is more your area of expertise too. But I'd be very interested to hear your take on this, Michael.
Right. Well, it's another reason why I chose to bring all these articles together and publish a book and this is something I've been trying to do for a while, is all that activism that we've seen in the past 2 or 3 years added to the trends that we've observed in the past 10 years in terms of identification, support for unification, support for independence, or support for the status quo, which has a majority of people right now. And I mean, let's not kid ourselves. Support for status quo means support for independence, because it is a recognition that the way things are right now, i.e. not part of the PRC, is the least bad option. It's probably even the best option for us. Mixed with the, as I said, this new definition or redefinition of what it means to be a Taiwanese, what it tells me is that social opposition to eventual unification with China, especially an authoritarian China, support for that is next to nil. So if by through economic incentives or a coercion or blackmailing or whatnot, Taiwan is forced to become part of the PRC entity, we're going to have major problems in the Taiwan Strait. I believe that the persistence and dedication of the thousands of people who have protested over the years has made it clear that those people would not allow themselves to be absorbed by China and not do anything about it, or not try to do anything about it. So I think it's very important for the people, to the rest of the world, to realize they need to pay attention to those voices as well. Now, the problem that we're facing is that most international media, those who actually have a presence in Taiwan, rarely, if ever, focus on those issues. They will focus on what the KMT says about cross-strait relations. They will quote Ma Ying-jeou saying that relations in the Taiwan Strait are the best they've been in the past 60 years. And unfortunately, more often than not, people overseas have the impression that there is overwhelming support across Taiwan for what's going on in terms of dialogue with China, in terms of rapprochement. And this feeds into the perception globally of the inevitability of unification with China. But if you pay attention to what's being said in Taiwan, like I've been doing over the years, you realize that people are, the majority of them are in favor of normalization with China. If you regard your country, that is Taiwan, as a normal country, of course you would want it to have better economic ties and business ties with the world's second largest economy. Of course, you would be willing to have Chinese students come to Taiwan and vice versa, send your kids to China, perhaps even work in China where the opportunities are right now. But that does not mean that those individuals, those people agree to being part of China. So normalization is key. So when you see headlines saying anti-China protesters, I always cringe because you talk with those individuals, they're not anti-China. But they are pro-Taiwan. And there's a very, very important distinction here. And they want the mechanisms that facilitate normalization with China to be democratic and to be transparent and to work for the interests of the Taiwanese. And I think that's where things went wrong last year. And that led to the Sunflower Movement, is that people recognized that the mechanisms that facilitate normalization were failing. They could not be trusted, nor could the individuals who are charged with doing so.
Mm-hmm. I have one of your articles open in front of me from last year. The headline is "Say Goodbye to Peaceful Unification." I was just reading the introduction. So yeah, it definitely speaks to that point you just made. Mm-hmm. Now let me just get back to the book a bit. Which of these essays, which of these articles was, I guess, not your favorite per se, because I know a lot of these topics are difficult to write about and difficult to cover, but you know, which one would you say is the most urgent for a reader that's opening up your book? If they had time to read one essay, which would you recommend?
Well, it depends who the audience is, but I would say that there's an article that says, "Wake Up Washington, All Is Not Well in Taiwan." And again, this speaks to what we were just discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. The reality that there's a perception out there, and it's a convenient one, that things are fine in the Taiwan Strait and that they're moving in the right direction. And it's a good thing because it means that Taiwan Strait has probably been neutralized as a future flashpoint. And this is something that you hear has a lot of currency in places like Washington, D.C., and London, and Ottawa, and in Canberra. And I think it's a very dangerous perception because it is illusory and it's momentary. Everybody's in favor of rapprochement and all that, but I sense that at some point in a not-so-distant future, there will be a moment of reckoning, where Beijing realizes that, okay, we've been giving all these things to your Taiwanese or Taiwanese friends across the Taiwan Strait, and we were nice to them, and we made all these trade agreements. We sent them millions of tourists to Taiwan every year. It boosts their economy. And still, those Taiwanese are not willing to rejoin the big, happy Chinese family, if you will. Now, given the current regime in Beijing that is markedly less patient than previous regimes, my fear is that at some point, President Xi or perhaps even his successor would decide that, okay, economic determinism is clearly failing, as it has failed in other parts of China, as in Tibet, for example, in Xinjiang. So what do we do next? Do we become even more coercive? Do we perhaps even rely on our military to finally resolve the issue? And my fear is that if the world is caught unprepared, if they were not already aware that there is trouble brewing in the Taiwan Strait, that things are actually not all that great in the Taiwan Strait, then they would be wrong-footed and they would not be able to respond in a way that would help Taiwan defend its way of life and maintain its democracy. So I'm calling for preparedness, for better intelligence as to what's going on here on the ground, and a better understanding that fighting for Taiwan does not mean that you're irrationally against China. I don't think that's the point in Taiwan. But there is a clear commitment within society, within the DPP, and also, very importantly, within the KMT to defend their way of life. I mean, support for unification with the communists within the KMT and among KMT voters is also very low. And that's very, very important. Because how often do we hear references to the pro-Beijing KMT or the pro-China KMT? That's not the point. I remember interviewing a senior KMT official over during a protest over the Senkaku Diaoyutai, and there were about 1,000 people in Taiwan who protested and ended up in front of the de facto Japanese embassy. And I was looking around a single KMT member or flag there. So I asked him, I said, why is it that the KMT is not there? And then he turned around, he scoffed and he said, no, we would not be caught dead with those crazies, those pro-unification crazies, right? I think it's very telling as well. People need to realize that the great majority of people within the blue camp, within the KMT, are also ultimately pro-Taiwan. They might not be as vocal saying that, but they are. They also enjoy their way of life. They also enjoy their democracy. They know all the problems that are plaguing Chinese society at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we might even see all of these issues start to come to a head in the not-too-distant future. Expectations right now are pretty high that the DPP might win the January 2016 election. And Beijing has been pretty vocal that it's not going to deal with the DPP, at least not the way it deals with the KMT right now, unless there's a change in the DPP's approach to cross-strait relations. The DPP has never embraced the 1992 consensus. They don't really officially buy into this whole one China policy. And Beijing has said, we're not going to deal with you unless you do that. So that's going to be a real test for Beijing's approach to Taiwan. If the Taiwanese people democratically elect a DPP president who has not accepted the 92 consensus, is Beijing actually going to follow through and cut off all of these new burgeoning ties that have been established with Taiwan over the past 7-8 years? And that could be a real turning point.
Yeah, well, as we know, Beijing has problems with democracy. That being said, we don't want to underestimate the ability of their officials to understand what's going on as well. We're hearing different things. I mean, yes, the Chinese regime is trying to pressure the DPP to move in a direction that would be more favorable to continuation of what we've seen in recent years. But that being said, the DPP itself has gotten a lot more pragmatic. And what will be important to look at is not so much whether the DPP officially recognizes the 1992 consensus or officially states that it acknowledges the One China policy and all that. What's going to be important is the substance of what the DPP is putting on the table in terms of cross-strait relations. That will eventually be made public, and I suspect that if people overseas and in Beijing can look beyond or look past the actual language, they will realize that there is quite a bit of substance to what the DPP is willing to do when it comes to cross-strait relations and continuing economic ties and all that. But ultimately, the 92 consensus is—I don't think it's that big of an issue. But China has a choice. If it really sticks to the language and the symbolism of One China that is contained in the 1992 consensus, then they could very well decide that the DPP, assuming that the DPP wins in 2016, it will not. Cooperate with the administration and punish Taiwan, if you will, for making the decision that they made. And that, if that were the case, I sense that it could mean economic trouble for Taiwan. Certainly would make the DPP look bad, if that is indeed the strategy in Beijing and with its allies in the KMT. Then we could perhaps conclude that they would think that the DPP would only have one term, and a very painful term at that, and that the CCP and the KMT are therefore focusing on the elections in 2016, hoping for a return of the KMT, even more powerful, more popular KMT. That's a dangerous gamble, though, because it could also backfire. If Beijing is seen to be punishing Taiwan for the decision that was made by the majority of its people democratically, it could very quickly embitter them and sour relations in the Taiwan Strait and undermine perceptions of China among the Taiwanese as well. So it's a play in the making. But ultimately, I would not be surprised if the DPP won in 2016, that Beijing would find a way working with it. It might not be ideal to them, but I sense that they realize, again, that the challenge over Taiwan is exceptionally difficult, and that reacting in a way that risks alienating the Taiwanese is not it's not in their best interest either.
All right. Unfortunately, Michael, that's all the time we have for on tonight's podcast, but I really hope that you'll come back and become sort of a regular here. I absolutely enjoyed listening to your analysis of what's going on in Taiwan. And obviously, as someone that's been reading your articles for such a long time, I hope that you'll continue to submit for us from the front lines, as you put it. So for all our listeners, the book is Black Island, 2 Years of Activism in Taiwan. It is on Amazon and I'm sure in a variety of other places. Definitely check it out if you enjoyed this podcast. And Michael, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was great fun.
Absolutely. And Shannon, thanks a lot too for joining me on the podcast.
Sure. Always a pleasure.